This is Ann Peckham. I'm a volunteer with the Oral History Department at the University of Wisconsin. I'm here with Don Klimpel. This is our second tape, side one. And Don is going to answer some more of the questions that came up after his first tape. And the first subject, Don?
Good morning, Ann. What I need to do, or what I would like to do, is go back to the 1968, actually when I was hired by University Hospitals. Director at that time of University Hospital Pharmacy was Winston Durant. And after I finished my graduate school, he was looking for some place to fit me into this organization at 1300 University Avenue. And we call it sometimes the old hospital. So that's the way I'll address it. And so I went to work in the old hospital then in 1968. And one of the biggest things pharmacy was doing in that time, in those years, was automating and coming up with the new concept at that time of unit dose. And we were just converting all of the university hospitals in Madison here over to unit dose on each of the nursing units. And my responsibility to start out with was a staff pharmacist, and then I moved up and start putting in unit dose on all the different nursing units in the old hospital. That took us some time to do that. That was over about a two-year period of time before we got everything unit dosed and all the units set up. And that was our first goal at eliminating some of the errors that probably people have when they administer medications, by providing unit dose to each of the patients and individualized.
And maybe you better tell us what unit dose is.
Okay, unit dose is any medication can be unit dosed. And what it is like one tablet or one capsule that's in a package that's labeled with what it is. So you don't send a bottle or a stock bottle to the floors or to the units and a nurse or somebody pulls one pill out and gives to a patient at a certain time and on a schedule. This is all in little packages. So indeed, if a patient doesn't take it or some reason they discontinue the meds, this can be put back in the inventory because nobody has really touched the medication. And so it was cost savings, plus it was a safety reason that we did all this. And we took some of that responsibility at that time away from the nursing staff because they didn't have to interpret, or they didn't have to go to stock bottles. They didn't have to do all that. So also we probably eliminated some safety patient error problems that we might have with medications. So that was, and the old hospital was, it was old at the time we were in there in 68. But pharmacy was predominantly located in the basement, as we called it. We'd have long halls, many little rooms, steam pipes running down the hallways and everything in those little rooms. And in the back of the hospital, as we call it, we had stuck in central services. So we had autoclaving in one little room, steam coming up all the time. I mean, it was horrendous how hot it was down there when they were trying to sterilize and do things. It was terrible. The pharmacy was, our offices were down there right across from the, we had a disabled group from the state of Wisconsin that would set up little coffee shops. We had a little coffee bar down there right across from the office and pharmacy. A lot of us would congregate there a lot of times, but and that was just in a hallway. And the pharmacy, the unit dose system that we were setting up at that time needed some space, and we just took one of the old rooms and converted it over. And there was dust and kind of dirty, and nothing was real clean down there. We also had what our famous room was called the ether vault, which is where we kept a lot of chemicals and things. And it got over the years, it got to be very crowded and very hazardous and needed to be cleaned out many times. And usually our graduate students, we'd give them that job to clean out the ether vault. That was part of their rotations. So the pharmacy was not, we had an outpatient pharmacy then on the first floor of the hospital. And where the president's dean's office is the front of the hospital. The pharmacy was straight north of that area, towards the back, towards Bardeen. And we didn't do a lot of outpatient in those days, but we did fairly good volume. It's not compared to what we do nowadays. So, all the other services in the basement, housekeeping, dietary, we were all in that same mode of location and all little rooms and very difficult to operate in.
The patient library was down there, yeah, too.
Yes, it was. It was miserable. But, you know, you have to think back at that time. Actually, it was a great facility for that time in life. I mean, it was, things got done well. We took good care of patients, and you know, actually it was a nice place to work at that time. And then came along about 1974 when they decided to change, and the state of Wisconsin was willing to finance their new $120 million hospital at that time, which $120 million was very cheap for that hospital. I mean, it was, if you put in today's money, I don't know how many millions, many more million than that would have cost us. So it was a good buy for the state at that time. Anyway, in 74, then we start planning for the new hospital. And the old hospital, I think the administrator at that time was Jim Varnum. Jim Tinker, we'll come into the story a little bit later. Jim Tinker was his associate hospital administrator. Jim Varnum was the director, the chief, or chief executive officer. Jim, and I don't remember the exact date that he left. He picked up and left and went to the state of Washington. While we were in the process of getting into the new hospital and building the new hospital. So he was there just before, in the old hospital, and just before we went into the new hospital. They didn't hire a new administrator at that time. Jim Tinker was promoted actually to the acting chief executive officer. And so Jim was actually the administrator responsible for moving over to the new facility in 1979 when we finally moved. And then Jim Tinker soon after that left and went to Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and then he's still there. So hospital administrators, I can remember back to Ed Connors. Ed Connors was a very good administrator that later went to Michigan and has done a lot of great things. He was the head of the, American Health Organization at one time too. So he did a lot of things in his life, and he's what really started my memory anyway of university hospitals, the old university hospitals out. So we had a lot of good assistant administrators, people that we trained and sent out all over the country, and there's a lot of them all over the country. And for many years, I hunted with them every year. You know, we would go to places like Maryland, we'd go to Idaho, we went to Montana, we'd go to Colorado, we'd go different places and hunt as a group. And so many of these people that are now retired, but were hospital administrators from university, we'd get together every year. So it was fun. A good group of people. So. When we were going to move then in 1979, we had a lot of planning into how we would move and who was going to move us and how the community would I mean, there's many, many volunteers and many different organizations that was willing and wanted to help us make the big move. Reynolds Moving and Transfer did the majority of the office equipment, the big pieces of equipment, all those kinds of things that had to be moved. And that was moved over a period of time, maybe a week they had moved all the things over. But the day we did the patient move, we let the census in the hospital drop so we didn't have too much trauma and too much a big load to move too many people. And then we used ambulances, we used volunteers, we used the military, we used all kinds of people, and we moved all the patients in one day. Things worked very smooth, and it was miraculous, actually, how well it turned out to be. it was great. It was a great feeling, and everybody just worked together. And at that time, we then found out problems with the new hospital, that you couldn't get a bed through the doorways because, indeed, they hadn't made some of the doorways big enough. And so we ran into some minor problems, and that goes back to the architects and things that we all learned later on. So they had to change a lot of that stuff. But that construction that took place, and we moved into in 1979, actually has never stopped, because we've been doing construction in the new hospital since 1979. There's always something that they're tearing into or doing with the hospital.
Did you have problems with the central supply with that system?
No, we did not, actually. Let me go into that a little bit. When we were in the planning stages of the automated system that we're going to put into the hospital, we pretty much knew that the architect, H, O, and K at that time, had made some suggestions to us about some other delivery systems that were in the country, and said, indeed, it might be worthwhile that we go look at a few of those, a couple individuals go look at them and see what they look like, and if indeed that might be a type of a system we would want to use for the university here. So a number of us then traveled to a couple places in this country. We went to Hoboken, New York, and we went to Omaha, Nebraska. The American Chain and Cable Company, which we use the acronym ACCO, has set up delivery systems in those hospitals using carts that were chain-driven in the floors or overhead chain delivery systems. So we went and looked at them and try to decide in part of our planning if that would be something we could work with and how we would have to change our systems. So we, after looking at them, we didn't made the decision, administration, everybody made the decision, we would go to the automated system and we would look at the ACCO system, American Chain Cable Company, their system, overhead delivery of carts, which means there's a channel, like a track, that a cart will travel on. And we would use it mainly in the central area of the hospital. The original concept was to have these cables, or these tracks from the receiving dock into the central core of the hospital, where the material system was really the center. And so things from the receiving dock can be delivered by carts to the center area. And then as we needed to provide things to the nursing units, clinics, whatever else in the other parts of the hospital, we would then have another system that would go out from the central services, elevator systems, what these carts would fit on. And then they would be programmed so they would come off on different floors. And then we have a mini little distribution system on each floor where the carts would come out and gather. And then we'd have some type of technician on the floor that would take those carts If it was pharmacy, we'd take them to the nursing unit. If it was food service, we'd take it to the refrigerator in the nursing unit. If it was linen to replace into the nurse servers, we would take it around and replace all the linen and then send the cart back downstairs when they were done doing that.
These were pushed?
They were pushed once they got to the floor.
Once they got to the floor.
And then they would be pushed by some type of technician. Actually, in that whole planning phase, and after we decided to do all this and the system went in, we eliminated the tracks from the receiving dock to central because we decided the volume and everything would be just as easy to push delivery carts to the central area. So that was one modification we made pretty quick, soon anyway. The other thing we had to do, we were changing our whole philosophy of deliveries of everything when we went from the old hospital to the new hospital. So therefore, we had to consolidate some of the dietary functions and personnel into the materials distribution area simply because we were going to do part of their functions. Housekeeping, who took care of linen and things in the old hospital, had to also, we were going to do that with the central service people or the materials distribution people. So therefore, that all had to be, we had to exchange personnel and we had new people that had to come into our system from those departments and had to be trained on the system. And so that was one of the things that we did a lot of training for. We did tapes and all kinds of training before we moved into the hospital, and then when we got into the new hospital, it was just on-the-job training is what it was. The other big thing that this automated system did for the hospital, or for all of us, is it consolidated all the collection of all the soiled items, all the trash, all the linen, all the food carts, all the OR instruments, everything came to one central area in the central services area, or materials distribution area. And then all those people were still under materials management. So indeed, then we would break it out. We would put the food service carts would be cleaned and go back into food service so they could reload them again for the next meal. All the trash was then put into a special room. And we also at that time had to break isolation trash from landfill trash out. And they would go into separate rooms and then people would take them out of the system. The linen was the same way. We had an outside service for linen. So we would load them in big carts, bags of linen, and that would all be taken out of the hospital also. But all of it was in one central area. OR instrumentation, that was part of the planning when we were moving into the new hospital, was OR would not be reprocessing any of their instruments, their basic instruments and the things they needed on routine in the operating room. They would now do that in the central area. So that meant all those soiled instruments from all the case carts, again, we set everything on case carts for the operating room. All the things that were soiled and come back to the central area would then go through a reprocessing, sterilization, and back into the system to the operating room. So it was very, very intensive, but we had a lot of change of personnel. And actually, there was, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but indeed, by all this consolidation, we saved maybe 5 FTEs. I don't remember the exact number, but it might have been 5 FTEs of people just by doing all this consolidation that actually we saved in the hospital. So instead of hiring more people, we were able to change some other people's functions or do something else with them. And over the years from 1979 until I left in 98, I think the ACL system, as I call it, automated system, probably downtime was probably less than 1%. Mm-hmm. So very, very efficient system, but I think that was mainly because of our plant engineering group, because they also really bought into this automation at the beginning, and they gave us tremendous service. I mean, they were always on top of anything that would happen. I mean, they just did an excellent job of keeping it running.
And who was in charge of that?
Luke Cole, most of the time that I can remember, anyway. Mm-hmm. And Luke Cole was the responsible person. He was the director of the department. Now, he had a number of people that in his department that he had trained to take care of our specific needs. But they were very reactive and very good for us. So the ACCO system was very, very efficient for us. And it's still running today, and it seems to be still very efficient. As I had mentioned once before, we never did a cost analysis to see over the years how much in manpower and dollars did we really save by having the automated system. It would have been a good study to do, and they probably still could do it, but I'm not sure who would do it. But so I think between the management engineers, between plant services or plant engineering, they absolutely kept that system in excellent condition and operations. It was great.
So, did you see this system anyplace except Hoboken and Iowa?
No, in Omaha, Nebraska, this was.
Omaha.
Not. There's a place, we were told by HONK at that time, that there was one more place that had it, and it was in Germany. And I would love to go to Germany, but they wouldn't send us to Germany. It was all on one level, so it was many acres and many, actually it was miles of this track system that was put in all on one level. Their hospitals in Germany, the one that they were talking about, didn't have different floors. It was all flat, so one story. And we never did get to look at that, but the ones we did look at, Omaha and Hoboken, they seem to be operating fairly well also with their systems, and we were all very enamored by the system anyway. So it worked well for us over the years.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the nurse server? It sounds as if somebody's running around serving
okay.
the nurses.
Well, the nurse server is part of the old Gordon Friesen concept that I had talked about a little bit before. Gordon Friesen, as I had mentioned, was an architect and a hospital administrator from Canada. And his concept was that, one of his concepts was that when you build facilities, you want to keep the people that are taking care of patients close to the patient and not have them running all over the system to get supplies or drugs or anything else, linens or any of that type of thing. So he actually recommended and was implemented in a number of hospitals things like nurse servers, which are little closets at the entryway of each of the patient rooms. And in these closets, you have an upper part of the closet and a lower part. The upper part of the closet has like a daily linen change. It has all the supplies like the alcohol swabs, the ear swabs, anything else that might be used, not in emergency, but just maybe used in patient care. And then in the bottom of that nurse server, as we call it, is soiled linen. And they have a door on each side. They have a door on the outside hall, and they have a door in the inside room. So what happens if a nurse or somebody wants to get into the cabinet or put soiled linen in the cabinet, they can put it in from the inside. Then we have technicians that go on the outside, going down the hallways, and they will resupply the supply items from the outside and pick up the soiled linen from the bottom on the outside in the hallway. And that led to, was part of, the concept of the automation. Then the ACCO system would also aid in all this, taking things away and bringing things up and doing all that. So that was kind of a total concept of actually patient care or services to the patient care units. So.
In the patient care units, were there clean rooms for central supply and dirty rooms for the used things? They weren't separated out on the floors?
In each of the nursing units, we do have, we call them team support areas, and they still, I think, today call them team support areas, where they have the pharmacy unit dose carts are set, where we have supply items, minor supply items that are on the shelves for daily use. We have no linen, however. They might pack a little linen away and hide it on you, but indeed there wasn't any linen. Just those types of supplies are in those team support areas.
Mm-hmm.
So we did have something. I mean, they weren't a void. Not everything came out of the nurse server. So if they did need something special, it would come off those carts.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had carts in these team support areas, and I'll define them as ACO carts. They're carts that are about a 4-foot cart by 2 foot and about 5 foot high. And they had shelves on them. And we would have these carts loaded with supplies that would sit in some of these team support areas. And they were a lot of specialty items and things that might need, depending on what kind of service, we would have a lot of their specialty items sitting on these carts. So that's how we would, that's how they would get some of those supplies instead of coming down to the bottom floor or lower levels or whatever you want to call it, and getting those items we would have. We also were able to use part of this automation. A pneumatic tube system was another concept that wasn't developed by Gordon Friesen, but it fit into the whole automation process, because there's many times on nursing units, offices, where they need to transfer like a record or a sheet of paper or even supplies or pharmacy items. We could always put in a pneumatic tube because we had a fairly large pneumatic tube, and we could deliver that very quickly to wherever they had to go. So it really, that was part of the automation and part of the modernization, I guess, of university hospitals at that time.
Was the capsule for the automatic pneumatic tube, was it about like the ones that in the drive-in banking?
It is. It's a little bit bigger than that. I think they're 3 by 9 inches, I think, is what they are. Mm-hmm. So they're a little bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
We got to the point where we could even send injectable drugs through the pneumatic tube. We'd have to have a sponge and a few things in it, so we'd have a fairly soft landing.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because sometimes when those go through that tube system, they go very rapidly. And what it would do is it may even unscrew caps or pull the plungers right out of a syringe if you let them in. So, I mean, it's fairly, but it was a learning. It was a learning curve for us, too. But it worked well.
Okay.
When Jim Tinker left, Jim was the acting CEO. He was not chosen or picked to be the new administrator. But that's the time Gordon Durzon came into the scene at that time. Gordon came from New York. He was administrator of one of the big hospitals in New York. He brought with him Les Brower, who was on the staff at University Hospitals for at least from the time I knew, 79 or 80 onto at least 98. So both of them were there at that length of time. Gordon had some new ideas. Gordon, being from the East, was, I think, his background and his family were in hospitals, also were involved in hospital administration. Not his folks, but his brother is a big hospital administrator at one time also in the country, and spent a lot of time with some of these big consolidators in the state of Utah and around the country. So Gordon came in with not so many ideas. Gordon is really unknown to a lot of people. He's a people person. He can be very direct sometimes, and but he's very concerned about patient care. And he was, right from the beginning, that was what he was concerned about. Now, in a big organization like we have, the CEO usually doesn't bother so much with patient care. They're usually involved more with the politics and the university and the medical school and all the rest of the deans of the schools. You know, they're all usually politicking. But Gordon was to the point where he liked to wander around and come to the units and come to the departments and see people and talk to you. Maybe harass you, but talk to you. He was just a very wonderful person, I thought, for that. In fact, way back, I mean, in the 70s, we had a strike.
You were saying in the 70s there was a strike?
Yeah, we had a strike. The hospital was unionized and has been unionized to state employees for many, many years. And we actually had a strike. Not many of the nurses left, but a lot of the service people went on strike. And what I'm getting at is Gordon's feel and sense. Gordon actually came in and he worked in the mail room. He worked on the receiving dock. He threw linen bags. I mean, he did all these kinds of things. Why we were on strike, you know, and that's a great accolade for something like that, I think. But he was very concerned about those things. And I think just by his getting people together, his staff together, he was able to, he could see down the road a little bit, and he could make these people work together. And just by doing that, I think he made the system very efficient, made it more efficient than it had been for a long time anyway. So, and I think that was probably one of his strengths, is just being able to get the people together and talk. And I had mentioned Les Brower before. Les was an engineer by training, and Les would kind of be Gordon's sounding board, and also he would articulate things a little better sometimes and outline them a little better, and he was very good at being able to follow through with some of Gordon's thoughts, and other people would pick up on them. So it was good, so very effective.
A good team.
It was, actually it was. So Gordy, and one of the questions that you had asked about was, what were his areas of responsibility? I don't really know. You know, he worked the goals that were set up by the hospital, the goal of patient care, the goal of research, education, and outreach. Those were the four goals. Gordon was involved in all those areas. I mean, he was strong in all those areas, and he was always out there. So, areas were, he was kind of responsible all over. How close did I work with him? One of the things in the new hospital was that administration was on the eighth floor. It was a long ways away from materials distribution. And I wanted, every day, I wanted to make sure that the administration knew I was at work, and I wanted to make sure they were at work. So I would go to the eighth floor every day. So I had a lot of contact with Gordon and everybody else up there. That was one of my jobs. I just wanted to make sure they were still around. And Gordon always had little tasks, special tasks for me. I mean, he'd always pick me out to do something special for him or whatever. So we worked fairly closely together. And today, now we're both retired. We both go to sports medicine. And we sit and talk, and we talk about the old times, and we talk about the new times. So it's a good time. And I think that's another thing about Gordon, now that he's retired. Gordon could have gone and lived probably any place else he wanted to. His folks lived in Hawaii for many years, and I think they probably have facilities or buildings over there or homes over there. He could go there and live. But Gordon likes and has enjoyed Madison so much that he and his wife both have stayed here in Madison. You know, I think that's great.
So, it is nice.
So that is very nice. Enough about Gordon. Privatization, that was one of the, I think that was one of probably Gordon's big goals. Not right away, but over the years, over maybe 15 years, of making the system work a little more efficiently and easily. Because when you, in the university system, it's so big, and there, it's not that it's, it's cumbersome. It's hard to get things done rapidly. And sometimes in the hospital professions, at least, you have to get things done a little quicker. You have to make some decisions that are a little different than what the university's decisions are. So they fought, not fought, they negotiated for many years to to make it easier for university hospitals to do things like purchasing some of the fiscal systems to make those a little easier so we could react faster to things. We could buy, we could sell, we could build, we could do things quicker. And then the public authority issue came up. They knew it was coming up, but they talked about it for a long time, and they outlined a system of where, indeed, the university hospitals would go out and become a public authority. However, on the board, the chancellor of the university would still be part of the hospital board, and probably a couple other representatives from the university would still be on the hospital board. So, indeed, big decisions that had to be made by the hospital would have still go through some of those people. So, indeed, they knew what was going on or could put a stop to it or whatever. So they still had control. But it opened up things for university hospitals, like purchasing, made it much more efficient. And we didn't have to go through quite as much political paperwork as we did otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
It made it much easier. And everything was very fair. I mean, we still had to do bidding. We still had to do all the things that people have to do. It's just that we could do it. We didn't have to go through another organization to do it. So we could do it faster, more rapidly.
Was that when you got into the just-in-time?
Yeah, and that's about that time then. The concept of just-in-time probably came around Deming and all of his work in Japan and all those places. You know, people were looking to make everything, all industries, more efficient. And just-in-time systems were one that indeed popped out and said, hey, if they can use it in the car industry, other industries, why not use it in the hospital industry also? So indeed, then about that time, we start looking at, can somebody do those kinds of, can we get rid of a warehouse that we have $1.5 million worth of supplies in that we keep all the time? Can we get rid of that warehouse and bypass the warehouse and just have a wholesaler out there someplace that can furnish us supplies, the things that we need, on demand, or just in time, as we call it? And lo and behold, in Wanakee, Medics, it's a big medical surgical supply house, was willing to get into it with us. And so indeed, we contracted them. And we bought about $1 million a month of supplies from them. And that was all computerized. So therefore, we would have, everything was barcoded. We would barcode our shelves or our supply areas. The barcoding system through the computer would be transferred to the Medics. They would fill that order and deliver it to us the next day, or sometimes the same day. We sometimes needed things the same day, and they would do that. They give us tremendous service. And I'm sure, and we eliminated the warehouse. The 112 North Lake Street is where we used to have a warehouse, is where Kohl Center is right now. It was going to be condemned anyway as soon as the Kohl Center came around. But indeed, before that, we had a big warehouse down there that we kept many things in. And so all that was eliminated, and we saved a number of, at least supply inventories that we had in that area. So I have a brick. I still have a brick from 112 North Lake Street.
That's wonderful.
Is that enough?
I think so.
That's maybe all I have to say at this time. I'd be happy to. Another individual that I think we should probably give our thanks to and give credit for a lot of the success of the University Hospital's new hospital is Bill Davis. I think Bill, over the years, actually he was involved, he is the number one person involved in the planning as we went along through the system, all the planning phases. He was involved in the move. He was involved in buying new equipment, deciding where we would store items that we didn't have space for anymore. He came up with storage space. Bill Davis actually was the person that probably kept the project going and kept the whole move and the whole relocation of the hospital very smooth. He did an excellent job. So.
Did he have people working with him?
Yes, he did. He had a lot of people working for him, but and you know, we would see him day to day and talk to him day to day. I probably don't remember some of their names, so I probably won't mention that. So I'll let Bill can do that.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Don.
You're
this
welcome.
Has been very, very interesting.
Good.
Thank you.